This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
We have sanctioned, I think, what looks like low-hanging fruit. That's still important to do, but I don't think that we should expect there to be a shift in the war effort as a result of this.
That's Cameron Hudson of the Center for Strategic and International Studies on the possible impact of new U.S. sanctions against Sudan's warring parties. Also, Zimbabwe's legislators passed legislation that the opposition say is aimed at silencing dissent. And Senegal's opposition leader is acquitted of two charges but sentenced to 2 years for another. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The U.S. Treasury Department has announced sanctions against four companies affiliated with Sudan's warring parties, two of them Al Junaid Multi-Activities Company and Trading General Trading. All are associated with paramilitary leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo and his family, while Defense Industries System and Sudan Master Technology are controlled by the Sudan Armed Forces. Also, the White House announced it's imposing visa restrictions against those, quote, perpetrating the violence and quote, in Sudan. The two actions came a day after the army withdrew from ceasefire talks with the paramilitary rapid support forces as the fighting continues. VOA's Nabil Biagio spoke with Cameron Hudson, senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, on the significance of the moves and their impact.
We certainly picked the right companies to target. These are companies that are at the heart of the military corporate establishment. But I don't think that coming as they do 6 weeks or 7 weeks into the conflict, that they're necessarily going to get the attention or strike fear or get the generals, frankly, to change their calculus about this war. It feels a bit like a warning shot, but that warning shot is coming well into the conflict already. So I'm not quite sure what the impact is going to be, if any, on the warring sides.
And in terms of economic interest and assets that can be affected by the sanctions and the visa restrictions, some people say, for example, Dagalo wouldn't care much about U.S. sanctions. His interests are with Russia and the Gulf countries and Libya. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what was not announced with this was a diplomatic strategy for how they see these sanctions being pursued and applied. I think without the cooperation of countries like the UAE, where some of these countries have their corporate headquarters, then I think there's no chance of these having any kind of impact. So certainly with Russia, I don't think Russia will be dissuaded at all. So some of the businesses and some of the countries that are already doing business with these entities, I think that they're unlikely to be dissuaded from continuing their work. But with countries like UAE, which has presumably been a U.S. ally and presumably the U.S. has an open channel of communication with, if they can't get them to equally apply these sanctions, then I think there's probably very little hope that they're going to have an impact.
And with regard to the military, the U.S. would also want an ally like Egypt to cooperate. Is that correct?
Well, presumably, yes. I think that, again, if no one takes these sanctions seriously, if they continue to do business with these corporations, then I think there's going to be very little impact. And frankly, anybody who's going to be doing business with entities that are already at war and where they've already had a military junta overthrow the government, they're clearly, I think, not worried about the reputational risk or even the potential legal risk of doing business with these entities. So we have sanctioned, I think, what looks like low-hanging fruit. That's still important to do, but I don't think that we should expect there to be a shift in the war effort as a result of this.
The announcement did not include names or any specific individuals targeted with sanctions. Can we surmise that the two top generals, Burhan, the army chief, and Dagalo, the RSF commander, are targeted directly?
No, we can't surmise that they've been targeted directly. I think that this feels like a warning shot to them. on the RSF side, the companies that have been targeted are at the heart of the Dagalo family empire. And so I think that it is a warning shot to them. But I think the fact that none of the generals being targeted suggests to me that Washington continues to believe that those generals have a role to play in the political talks going forward, that they have a role to play in the Jeddah discussions. And I think that shows a kind of continuation of a misguided U.S. approach, where we continue to prioritize the military actors in a political conversation going forward. And until we decide that those actors are no longer legitimate in the political talks, and we would decide that by sanctioning them directly, then I think we hold open the possibility that they continue to play a role, which is very dangerous.
That's Cameron Hudson, Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio today in Washington. Despite spirited objections from opposition legislators, Zimbabwe's ruling party-dominated National Assembly has passed the so-called Patriotic Act, which criminalizes willfully undermining the sovereignty and national interest of Zimbabwe. Kutsnai Musangi has the details.
The ruling ZANU-PF party used its majority in the National Assembly to push the statute, formerly known as Criminal Law Codification and Reform Amendment Bill. It will now go to the Senate, where the party also has a majority of seats, and then to the president to be signed into law. The opposition says the bill targets political opponents and gags freedom of expression and of the press, especially before upcoming elections on August 23rd. Member of Parliament Innocent Gwanese, a lawyer and chief whip of the opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, told VOA that the passage of the law is yet another example of ZANU-PF's dictatorship, cautioning that all citizens should be worried.
The rights which are enshrined in the Constitution to free expression, to free association and so on, apply to all in Santi. It's not just about people who are political animals. So it is in this vein that I would urge the people of Zimbabwe to actually speak with one voice.
Ever since it was brought before Parliament in 2020, ZANU-PF members have been defending the bill. They say it is necessary in order to instill a sense of patriotism and protect national interest, citing the fact that even the U.S. has a similar law known as the Logan Act. The measure, passed in 1799, prohibits citizens from corresponding with a foreign government without the approval of the U.S. officials. No one has ever been prosecuted under the law. ZANU-PF Chief Whip Pupuraito Garepi said the Patriotic Act is a reflection of the will of the people, as citizens were consulted through parliamentary public hearings in accordance with the constitutional requirements.
The passing of this law that relates to the Patriotic Act was done through due process of parliament. And I am so happy that we got where we wanted to be, and the people of Zimbabwe were involved.
The legislation seeks, among other things, to have mandatory sentences for rape, but it is the patriotic aspects of the bill that have caused controversy. Penalties under the bill range from fines as well as custodial sentences of up to 20 years in prison and the death sentence or life imprisonment for commission of crimes considered as treasonous. Musa Kika, a lawyer and the director of the Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum, says the law negates whatever intent, commitments and promises the ruling ZANU-PF has been making about reform.
All sorts of civil and political rights that the Constitution gives are infringed by this kind of bill. In my estimation, this bill is the most draconian law that we have seen in independent Zimbabwe. Laws like POSA and IPA and even the PVO bill that is currently in the making, they come nowhere near the kind of infringements that this bill will infringe on our constitutional society and on the rights of our people.
Kika says there's a good chance that the Senate will also pass the law. It will then await presidential assent, but President Emmerson Mnangagwa may choose not to sign and allow it to lapse when Parliament dissolves on the eve of elections. Both houses of Parliament recently passed another controversial bill, the Private Voluntary Organizations Amendment Bill, which would allow the government to designate those NGOs it alleges to be at high risk to terrorism. It would also ban them from engaging in political activities, including human rights activities. but Mnangagwa has yet to sign the bill following wide criticism. Efforts to solicit comment from Justice Minister Ziyambi Ziyambi have so far failed as his mobile phone went unanswered. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, this is Kudzanai Msengi.
Libya's acting interior minister Imad Trabelsi admitted that clashes occurred in Tripoli between two state-recognized forces, the Deterrence Agency for Combating Terrorism and Organized Crime and the Libyan Army 444 Combat Brigade. Some experts say the armed conflict in the West confirms that there's no monopoly on the use of legitimate force and does not bode well for the elections, the Tripoli-based Libyan prime minister, or for Libya in general. Wolfgang Puschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shnawi what prompted the clash and how serious it was.
Forces before and Rada Force are the two most powerful militias in the greater Tripoli area, and therefore these clashes were in particular of significance. Force 444 was originally established in 2020 as an offshoot of Rada Force, and originally they were partners. They had divided the roles in between them, and as such, Rada was responsible for Tripoli and Force 444 for the surrounding areas. Initially, Force 444 received massive support from Turkey, especially in the form of weapons and training. And this force was intended to serve as a role model for the new security forces. However, over the last couple of months, Rada has increasingly considered Force 444 to be more of a competitor than a partner. Both have operated increasingly in each other's area of responsibility, and this didn't went well. The recent fighting was triggered by the arrest of a senior Force 444 officer downtown Tripoli by Rada Force. The day before, a former Alkani Brigade officer from Tahuna, who is now a company commander in the Rada Force, was arrested by Force 444. He was supposed to set up a branch of Rada Force in Tahuna, in the hinterland of the area of responsibility of Force 444. So Force 444 mobilized all available forces and moved to Maitiga Airport, the main base of Rada, and wanted to get the officer released. There were severe clashes, even tanks and artillery were used. A couple of armored personnel carriers were destroyed. And after a couple of hours, the severe fighting ceased and the ceasefire was mediated. The Force 444 captain, who was detained by Rada, was released. In exchange, Force 444 released about 180 members of Rada Force who were detained in Tahuna. However, unfortunately, the underlying conflict between Rada Force and Force 444 over the spheres of influence has not been resolved.
The U.S. Embassy to Libya said that the United States is closely following and with concern the situation in the city of Zawiya amid reports of the use of weapons in civilian areas and called on all Libyan leaders to do everything in their power to calm the situation and take all necessary precautions to protect the lives of civilians. Who is capable of doing that in Libya?
With regard to the drone strikes that took place since last Thursday, it is quite easy. Either Prime Minister Dabeiba, who requested the strikes, or the Turks, who conducted them with their combat drone. With regard to stabilizing the city of Zawiya, the situation is much more complex. Zawiya is a hub of human trafficking and fuel smuggling. Most of the militias there are fighting for controlling this multi-million business. Almost all the militias in this city belong either to the Ministry of Defense or the Ministry of Interior. So all of them are official forces. I would say the best way to contain this mess would be probably to make fuel smuggling less profitable. This could be done by reforming the subsidy system. In other words, to pay cash directly to the Libyan citizens instead of subsidizing the fuel prices themselves. However, I have no illusion that this could end all the fighting. There are simply no, or at least not enough, security forces available who are really loyal to the government and who are not involved in crime themselves.
The UN envoy to Libya, Abdullahi Batili, paid a visit to Benghazi, where he met Khalifa Haftar and discussed developments in the political and security situation. And Batili emphasized the need to provide a safe environment that enables peaceful and inclusive elections in 2023. Is that feasible?
There is no single politician or strongman who is able to provide a safe environment throughout the country. It will be necessary for UN and the international community to discuss about security for the election with several of the local security leaders. I would say, with the exception of contested areas like Zawiya and the remote south, it should be possible to maintain a more or less secure environment for the elections. But Haftar and the militias are certainly able to influence the elections in their sense. and several of them will certainly give it a try. Without international supervision, without close international supervision of the elections will become a mess. It will be crucial to prevent intimidation of the voters and to prevent widespread election fraud.
That was Wolfgang Puschdai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya. He was speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shanawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Hundreds of South Africans today marched to President Cyril Ramaphosa's offices at the Union Buildings in Pretoria, demanding that all illegal foreigners leave the country. The group is composed of a number of community pressure groups and smaller political parties known for their anti-foreigner stance. The marchers vowed to continue protesting until Ramaphosa personally informs them when the foreigners will leave. Thuso Kumalo reports from Pretoria.
The multitude of protesters arrived at President Cyril Ramaphosa's Union Buildings offices singing, dancing and chanting anti-foreigner slogans. Freeman Bengu, the organizer of the march and member of Sisonke People's Forum, accused the government of failing to implement immigration laws.
Our country has plenty of problems, education, health system, everywhere. Even policing, we've got problems with that. Add on top of that the issue of illegal immigrants. It's not sustainable. Something has to be done.
Members of the Old Truck Drivers Foundation, who were also part of the march, complained that foreign nationals were also choking the trucking industry. Other protesters accused foreign nationals of being behind violent crime in South Africa. Zandile Dabula, the National Secretary of Operation Dudula, an organization known for expressing anti-foreigner sentiments, rejected allegations that they are xenophobic.
We need a mass deportation. That's the most thing that we want as South Africans. We want South Africans to be prioritized, especially in our healthcare facilities, schools especially, because we have kids who are still not placed as yet. And foreign national kids are being placed at schools.
The march takes place at a time when unemployment and poverty are growing in South Africa. Over the years, South Africa has experienced a string of xenophobic violence, with locals accusing immigrants of stealing their jobs and causing crime. President Cyril Ramaphosa's office did not comment Thursday on the protesters' demands. However, he has previously told marchers to express their concerns in peace and never to embark in acts of xenophobic violence. Some foreign nationals have described the protest as an act of xenophobia and fear it could lead to attacks on foreigners. Although foreigners have been linked to some crime, there are no reports showing it is disproportionate to their numbers. In addition, the government has not shown data that foreign nationals contribute significantly to unemployment. Reporting for VOA News in Pretoria, I am Thuso Kumalo.
A court in Dakar, Senegal today acquitted top opposition politician and presidential hopeful Ousmane Sonko of allegations of rape and making death threats, but sentenced him anyway to 2 years in prison for corrupting youth. Sonko was accused of raping a woman who worked in a massage parlor in 2021 and making death threats against her. He denied wrongdoing and boycotted the court proceedings. Reporter Alpha Jallo, who is in Dakar, tells me that spontaneous protests broke out all across Senegal today, especially at the university in Dakar, following the announcement.
See, I just passed there, but it was so hot between the students and the riot police. And also, where I am not far away from Tillen, which is also inside Dakar, there's also some demonstrations. The verdict has been announced about Mr. Sonko being sentenced to 2 years, in jail for what we call for corrupting young people.
And before we get into the specifics of the verdict, just going on with what you saw today, have those demonstrations that you just described, have they been peaceful?
Yes, the one at the university is very violent because I can see that, a black smoke, smoldering almost everywhere. So it is very difficult even for motorists, to drive. Also, all those, business centers around the university area, they have all shut up their shops and they are all heading home. And most offices today, even inside Dakar, most offices haven't gone to work. Immediately the verdict has been pronounced, some people, they quickly, you know, left their offices heading home. So I am also getting news that in Pekin, which is the outskirts of Dakar, and Gejewai and also Tengej, there are also some demonstrations.
Does this verdict mean that Mr. Sonko cannot run in next year's presidential elections, or can he appeal this verdict, this two-year sentence, which is not on rape, as you point out, and still run?
Just a few minutes ago, I heard one of his lawyers, Pal, who is also the spokesperson for his past party, the Patriots. He said that they are going to appeal. But then it is also in the Senegalese judiciary system, if somebody is tried in absentia, it is always difficult for him to do the verdict. But they said that since he is cleared from the criminal allegations, they can appeal to the higher court. That's what he said. And in a very short period, they will announce a press briefing, and people will know, what is their next move.
Sonko's supporters say the charges against him are politically motivated. What does the government say? And if you could, describe what the court means by corrupting youth, this charge that he was found guilty of.
That's very funny to describe, because this is what is surprising so many people. They said that since the beginning of this case in February 2021, and so many people, about 20 people lost their lives, series of violence. And of course, so many businesses were vandalized, so a lot of destruction. So if this case is ending here, saying that Mr. Sonko is only charged for corrupting young people. Well, I talked to somebody who said that, corrupting young people means maybe, giving them money in order to get, what the person wants from them, whether it is, he was cleared of the rape allegation. Sarah's lawyer is still maintaining Mr. Sonko and her client, they had some intimate, very close relationship, and then something have, transpired between them.
That's reporter Alpha Jallo. He was speaking to me earlier today from Dakar. Aminata Touré is the former campaign director of President Macky Sall of Senegal, who is now an opponent of the president. He told VOA's French to Africa service regarding the Sonko sentencing, "I believe it's a very harsh punishment, it's an unfair punishment, and it's more of a political sentence," end quote. Tunisia's Magistrates Association marked the anniversary of President Kais Saied's firing of 57 judges by protesting against presidential control of the judicial system, degradation of the rule of law, and imprisonment of judges. Reporter Alicia Volkman has more from Tunis.
Today we are marking 1 year since 57 judges were sacked by the president. Judge Anas Hamedi, president of the Magistrates Association, led the protest by judges at the Palace of Justice in the centre of Tunis. 1 year ago, President Kais Saied dismissed 57 judges and 13 came under investigation allegations of corruption, including a female judge who was charged with adultery. 6 weeks later, Saied changed the constitution, bringing the judiciary and the justice system entirely under his control. Despite the Court of Administration ruling in favour of the judges and ordering that they be reinstated, the president has refused to comply. As the thunder rumbled, the judges called for a free judiciary and the return to the rule of law. They are also demanding for the release of Judge Bashir Akrami, who was arrested and imprisoned for alleged involvement in the assassination of politician Chokri Belaid in a terrorist attack in 2013. His wife was present holding a poster with his photograph.
That is reporter Alicia Volkman reporting from Tunis. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbel Yabro, and engineer, Shogun Chong, thanks for choosing VOA.